From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as Fort Hood Army Base wakes up to another tragedy, more details emerge raising questions over the psychological state of the gunman responsible.
He was undergoing a variety of treatment and diagnoses for mental health conditions, ranging from depression to anxiety.
Also today, Moscow, we have a problem. Why NASA is suspending its relationship with the Russian government. And we talk to an interrogator with 30 years' experience about the explosive contents of the Senate report into the CIA's interrogation record.
The knowledge of torture employed by the United States government served to increase the number of young men who joined extremist groups with the specific mission of harming U.S. national interests.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. Army is investigating after a gunman opened fire at the Fort Hood Army Base in Texas late Wednesday. Authorities say the gunman, who killed three people and himself, was being treated for mental and behavioral issues. 16 people were injured in the shooting spree, the second similar event at Fort Hood in just 4 years. Our U.S. correspondent Simon Marks says the motive for the attack is still being investigated.
The gunman, identified as Army Specialist Ivan Lopez, had spent 4 months in Iraq in 2011 and was being evaluated for post-traumatic stress disorder, although he hadn't officially been diagnosed with PTSD. President Obama described himself as heartbroken by events at Fort Hood, where in 2009, 13 people were killed when an Army major ran amok.
As we learn more about what happened and why, we're going to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to keep our troops safe and keep our troops strong, not just on the battlefield, but also when they come home.
The authorities say Wednesday's gunman bought his weapon, a semi-automatic pistol, recently. A female soldier is being widely praised for confronting him in a car park where he killed himself.
Israel will not release a fourth batch of Palestinian prisoners as promised, following a push by the Palestinians for more recognition at the United Nations. The latest spat has further threatened U.S.-backed peace talks between Israel and the state of Palestine. Li Ling Tan reports from New York.
In what appears to be another tit-for-tat move in an 8-month peace process that has yielded little, Israel has cancelled the expected release of a fourth group of Palestinian prisoners, saying it was contingent on the Palestinians' refrain from seeking further UN recognition. On Tuesday, the Palestinians applied to join 15 UN conventions and treaties, saying Israel had not released the prisoners. As part of the Middle East peace process, the Palestinians had promised to suspend UN membership applications in return for Israel's release of Palestinian prisoners, but the latest deadlock has thrown the already frayed negotiations into further disarray.
An Associated Press report says the U.S. government secretly financed a social network in Cuba to organize political demonstrations and undermine the country's communist government. Patrice Howard reports.
The text message program, a so-called Cuban Twitter, drew tens of thousands of subscribers who were unaware it was backed by the U.S. government. The AP report says the project was used to stir political unrest. It evaded Cuba's internet restrictions for more than 2 years. The project, dubbed Zunzuneo, slang for a Cuban hummingbird's tweet, was publicly launched shortly after the 2009 arrest of American contractor Alan Gross in Cuba. He was imprisoned while trying to expand internet access in the country. The report says it's unclear whether the project was legal under U.S. law, which requires written authorization of covert action by the president and Congress. Documents reveal the team found evidence Cuban officials tried to break into the system.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A second large earthquake with a magnitude of 7.6 struck northern Chile late Wednesday. The aftershock comes less than 24 hours after an 8.2 magnitude earthquake that rocked the northern coast of Chile on Tuesday. So far, authorities have reported only 6 deaths from the original quake. However, more than 2,600 homes have been destroyed, and millions of people have been forced to evacuate the port cities. The United Nations says there are now more than 1 million Syrian refugees living in Lebanon. In total, the UN estimates half of Syria's population have fled their homes to escape the fighting over the last 3 years. The head of the United Nations Refugee Agency called it a devastating milestone. And the U.S. space agency NASA is suspending most contacts with Russia. The move is part of the U.S. response to the unfolding crisis in Ukraine. Steve Mort reports from Florida.
Nearly all business between America's space agency and the Russian government is on hold because of Russia's decision to annex Crimea. With the exception of the International Space Station program, NASA's suspending meetings, communications, and any travel to and from Russia. The actions being taken for what NASA calls Russia's ongoing violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden recently testified before Congress that mutual cooperation between both nations is required to keep the International Space Station operational. Currently, the U.S. pays the Russians for rides into orbit, and two Americans now live on the ISS. Steve Mort, Orlando.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. New information is coming out about the veteran soldier who went on a shooting spree Wednesday night at Texas's Fort Hood military base that killed three people, injured more than a dozen, and ended with his suicide. The violent incident comes just days after the release of a study that found nearly a third of recent veterans report mental health problems upon return, and more than a half know a service member who has attempted suicide. With the investigation still ongoing, our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein heard from lawmakers, veterans and military officials about what they know so far about the incident and what can be done to improve care for returning veterans.
U.S. Army Secretary John McHugh briefed lawmakers and the public Thursday morning on the identity of the Fort Hood shooter. 34-year-old Army Specialist Ivan Lopez was born in Puerto Rico and served 9 years in the Puerto Rican National Guard. He then served in two deployments to Iraq as a truck driver.
His records show no wounds, no involvement, direct involvement in combat. He was undergoing a variety of treatment and diagnoses for mental health conditions, ranging from depression to anxiety to some sleep disturbance. He was prescribed a number of drugs to address those, including Ambien. He was seen just last month by a psychiatrist. He was fully examined. And as of this morning, we had no indication on the record of that examination that there was any sign of likely violence, either to himself or to others, no suicidal ideation.
McHugh told senators that a background check on Lopez showed no involvement with extremist organizations of any kind, and the motivation for the violence remains unknown. It's the third major shooting at a U.S. military installation in just 5 years, and the second at Fort Hood, which also has one of the highest suicide rates of any U.S. base. Matt Howard with Iraq Veterans Against the War has spent the last 2 years interviewing hundreds of service members and veterans at Fort Hood and said he uncovered some troubling trends.
Service members were very frequently being redeployed, and often they were seeking care around PTSD or traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma, some of the invisible wounds of war, and doctors were diagnosing them with that and recommending that they not be redeployed, and in fact their commanders were sending them anyway. What we're finding is that this is, has a compounding impact on trauma, that folks are, essentially being re-traumatized.
Earlier this week, The Washington Post published a new survey of the more than 2.5 million people who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and found that some of these same problems extend beyond Fort Hood. More than half of those surveyed said their physical or mental health is worse than it was before deploying, and 41% said they now experience outbursts of anger. More than half said they know a fellow service member who has attempted or committed suicide. Tom Tarantino with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America said these findings match his organization's own studies, which reveal that about 22 veterans take their own lives every day.
Suicide isn't the problem. It is the end result of about 20 problems. It is a tragic consequence of failures in the system, of the inability to sufficiently find a job, and the inability to get health care if you need it. And all these factors go into the point where someone becomes desperate enough to want to take their own life. And if we constantly focus on preventing the act of suicide, we're never going to solve the problem.
Tarantino, who served as a platoon leader in Iraq in 2005, emphasized that he does not want to speculate about the connection between last night's Fort Hood shooting and the broader issues of mental health care for veterans, as many questions about the case remain unanswered. But he says regardless of the results of that investigation, there is a lot Congress can do right now that would make a major difference.
We're talking about things as simple as taking mental health care appointments after business hours and on weekends. Veterans work. And it's not always easy to get off work in the middle of the day. And when you're in crisis, if you have to choose between your livelihood and choose between your health care, that is a serious barrier.
The Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America are backing a bill just introduced called the Suicide Prevention for America's Veterans Act, which would help the VA hire and train more mental health care professionals and implement better communication and records sharing with the Pentagon as people transition to civilian life. But with Congress unlikely to quickly pass a bill, the group is also calling on President Obama to issue an executive order to implement some of these reforms before Memorial Day. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. The Senate Intelligence Committee will vote Thursday on whether contents of a report on the CIA's post-9/11 detention and interrogation program should be declassified and made public. Proponents of torture techniques, or so-called enhanced interrogation, have long lauded its role in saving American lives by guarding against the threat of terrorist attacks in the US. But the Senate report concluded that the CIA misled the government on aspects of its controversial program and its efficacy in obtaining vital information. The Senate panel will submit the entire 6,000-page report to the White House, which will have final say on the declassification. Stephen Kleinman has carried out interrogations throughout his career as an intelligence officer, and he began by telling me what these revelations would mean for the debate on torture.
What we're going to find is case studies and evidence to strongly suggest that the so-called enhanced interrogation program was wholly ineffective, and even on top of that, the fact that it went much deeper and darker than the American people were advised that it would. So it's a combination of performing methods or using methods that were consistent with what we've seen tracing back to antiquity in terms of physical, psychological, and emotional abuse, but yet in contrary to what we were told by very senior members of the government, that it was not, in fact, an effective way of getting reliable information.
These techniques being incorporated by the CIA, what did they involve?
So that include throwing people against walls, slapping, being held in stress positions, for example, to be on your knees for an extended period of time with your hands above your head on a concrete floor. Now, if that sounds benign, one need only do that for a minute, and you'll see how painful it is. Beyond that, sensory deprivation, isolation, dietary manipulation, time manipulation, all these things can really rapidly undermine somebody's emotional state and psychological state. In fact, to the point where psychoses are observed in a very quick fashion.
But these controversial techniques, the former President George W. Bush, he said that they saved American lives.
Well, see, I think that's probably going to be one of the most damning conclusions in terms of, for those who have been supporters of the enhanced interrogation paradigm, that, in fact, it didn't do that. And, in fact, I think an argument can be made, not only did it not save American lives, for instance, prevent future attacks, but just the knowledge, the awareness of what went on at Abu Ghraib, what went on at Guantanamo, what went on elsewhere around the world, that actually served, and we have very strong evidence. I mean, we have strong intelligence to support the contention that the knowledge of torture employed by the United States government served to increase the number of young men, mostly young men, who joined extremist groups, violent extremist groups, with the specific mission of harming U.S. national interests.
You're a career intelligence officer. You yourself have had to interrogate suspects. How did you go about it if you weren't employing the techniques that the CIA say prevent terrorist attacks?
Yes, I've conducted hundreds, literally hundreds of interrogations. around the world, and I've supervised thousands more, and I've been involved with research. You know, what it all stems from and what it all must be based on is somebody's memory. I mean, that's what interrogation is all about, getting access to somebody's uncorrupted memory and using harsh techniques, again, whether it's emotional, physical, or psychological. The first result, the first effect is to undermine an individual's ability to recall. Some very subtle but very effective techniques that are compliant with the most rigorous standards of human rights. For example, Dr. Robert Cialdini from Arizona State University and his colleagues have identified six fundamental principles of persuasion that have informed all of the advertising industry. I mean, it literally gets people to buy things they don't need with money they don't have until they whistle right past broke. So they're very, very powerful and very subtle to the point that even if you're aware of them, and so the ability to give something to a detainee, a cup of tea, a cigarette, or even more, a concession on your own, saying that, you know, I concede that maybe our policies here in Afghanistan have made things worse, reaches out to them, and in reciprocation, we often get information back.
If the rules are rewritten for the Central Intelligence Agency, how will they react to that if there is another attack on a large-scale terrorist attack on U.S. soil? What will this mean for the agency if they can't actually employ those techniques? Do you expect them to take this empathetic approach?
That's an excellent question. It doesn't matter the circumstances. I mean, the U.S. population has a right to be angry, to be fearful, to want revenge after an attack. But professionals, like my colleagues and I, who are trained to interrogate, we need to walk into that room without an ego, without an emotion, without an opinion. Interrogation is not a silver bullet. It has its opportunities, and it also has areas where it's of no use. How we respond, you know, the event that we're trying to support, whether it's a terrorist attack or a conventional war with a symmetric enemy, it doesn't matter. Interrogation works the same way each and every time.
Career Intelligence Officer Stephen Kleinman. Now, NASA has suspended its relationship with the Russian government over the ongoing Ukrainian crisis. With the exception of the International Space Station program, NASA is suspending meetings, communications, and any travel to and from Russia. The American Space Agency took the decision following what it called Russia's ongoing violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. For more on the gravity of this breakdown in relations, I spoke to FSN's Steve Mort in Florida.
Well, what it actually means is that most business between America's space agency and the Russian government is on hold, with the exception of the International Space Station program. Now, NASA says it's suspending meetings, communications, and any travel to and from Russia. The action is being taken for what NASA calls Russia's ongoing violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Now, NASA's decision was revealed in a leaked memo, which also says NASA officials can still attend multilateral meetings outside Russia, where Russian representatives are present. Interestingly, these restrictions, in fact, mirror those that are in place vis-a-vis China. The U.S. fears NASA cooperation with China might make it easier for the Chinese to copy U.S. technologies. In fact, currently, Chinese citizens are not allowed to access any NASA facilities.
And Steve, how has Russia reacted to the suspension?
Well, Russia hasn't in fact said a lot on this issue. Moscow says it regrets the decision to halt cooperation. The country's deputy foreign minister described it as a U.S. decision. But the feeling in Moscow is that Russia's space program will not be significantly affected by the move.
How reliant are NASA on this partnership with Russia? Is this a position the space agency can afford to take, especially since the lights were turned off on the U.S. shuttle program just a few years back?
Well, in fact, just recently, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden testified before Congress on the importance of U.S.-Russia ties with regards to the space program. Bolden is on record as saying that mutual cooperation is required to keep the space station operational, and that, I think, is why we see the ISS exempted in this latest announcement. But there is a lot of cooperation between the two sides, which is why this is significant. For example, the U.S. pays the Russians for rides into orbit on board Russia's Soyuz capsule, capsules, which are at the moment the only spacecraft that can fly NASA astronauts to the International Space Station. But, you know, looking ahead to the future, NASA is backing the development of a privately built alternative to replace the space shuttle, which, of course, has now been decommissioned. It's hoped a U.S. spacecraft that can carry astronauts to the ISS will be operational by 2017. And, in fact, to add to the dependency the U.S. has on Russia, many rocket launches from the U.S. depend on Russian engines, which power the workhorse-like Atlas V rocket that's often used to launch satellites into orbit. The Defense Department, though, is understood to have asked the Air Force to look into alternatives for sending up military satellites.
And could U.S. astronauts currently on the ISS be affected by this breakdown in relations?
Well, not according to NASA. NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden has said that the relationship between the Russian and U.S. space agencies is normal when it comes to their partnership on the space station. That's despite the situation in Ukraine. And from the U.S. point of view, Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, is not in a position to retaliate by refusing to allow U.S. astronauts aboard the Soyuz. Basically, the position is that Russia will not be able to carry out its normal ISS operations without the U.S. Just to note, there are three Russians, two Americans, and one Japanese astronaut on board the International Space Station.
Steve Mort in Florida. Now, it's no secret that technology is rapidly changing, getting smaller and cheaper to manufacture. So much so that today, most of us carry around some form of high tech in our pockets. Now, environmental scientists at Microsoft Research in the United Kingdom are developing new ways of using miniaturised technology to help with wildlife conservation. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell has the story.
On the rooftops of Cambridge, England, researchers are testing out what they hope will one day become commonplace on the plains of Africa. It's a small GPS tag called a Mataki tracker device. It can be attached to an animal and interrogated from the air via a second GPS tag placed on a flying quadcopter or drone. As engineer Siamak Tavakoli explains.
So that is going to fly towards actually where the species is and then hover around there so to let the data to be downloaded. If you have a drone, you just command your drone to come back to your office, yes, from your window perhaps.
Not only will this process be a time saver for conservationists, but these devices will also reduce manpower in tracking animals and may even help save endangered species. The process of attaching sensors and high-definition cameras to automated drones is being explored at Microsoft Research's lab and overseen by the project called Technology for Nature. As the name suggests, Microsoft Research is a computer science research organization which was created by the Microsoft Corporation software company in 1991. Lucas Joppa, a scientist at the lab, says that one of the aims of emerging technologies like this is to help protect endangered species.
When you're talking about specific things like rhino and elephant poaching, which you've seen an extremely disturbing kind of rise over the past 2 years, two things are going to combine to bring those down to more reasonable levels or hopefully eradicate them entirely. First one is policy, and the second one is technology.
So using GPS tracking devices and drones could make keeping tabs on endangered animals a whole lot easier. But what it also shows is how integral technology now is for conservationists. The Technology for Nature project has even developed networking hardware so that information can be passed from one device to another and stored.
Every animal that's wearing one of these devices, when it comes in contact with another animal that's wearing one, they set up a communication channel and they start talking to each other. And so now you can get a lot more data back from just one animal. We call them ecological informants.
And as technology continues to advance, it's likely that we may see animals in the wild living side by side with drones or quadcopters in the near future. Natalie Powell, Cambridge.
And finally tonight, during its 400-year history, 15 million people were victims of the slave trade. To mark the International Day of Remembrance, the United Nations has held a screening of a new film by an African director that looks at the impact and eventual abolition of slavery. The film, Bell, has been described as a period drama with much greater significance. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
Do not be afraid. I am here. to take you to a good life, a life that you were born to.
Bell tells the story of Dido Elizabeth Bell, the illegitimate mixed-race daughter of a Royal Navy admiral, who was raised by her father's aristocratic uncle.
Ensure that she is in receipt of all that is due to her as a child of mine.
Do you have in mind my position?
That is simply impossible.
What is right can never be impossible.
Based on true events, it shows Bell's struggle with the social traditions of the time. Her lineage allows her certain privileges, but the colour of her skin prevents her from fully entering English upper-class society.
Why do you not dine with your family ever?
Because that is not correct.
The special screening of the movie at the United Nations was followed by a discussion with the film's director, Amara Sante, and the actress who plays Belle, Gugu Mbatha-Raw. It's not often a film gets shown at the UN. For Belle to be screened here clearly highlights its importance, something not lost on Gugu.
You suddenly realise that the message of the film can reach such a significant audience, and the themes of the film are as contemporary as ever, you know, even though it is a period drama. And the timing of it, you know, remembering slavery at the moment, it's just a huge honour to be able to be a part of it and celebrate.
The event was held in recognition of the UN's International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. It's a special UN-designated day to honour the 15 million men, women and children who were victims of slavery during the trade's 400-year history. The theme of racism is central to the film. The director, Amara Sante, says her family faced similar problems with racism as she was growing up in England.
My parents came from West Africa, from Ghana, in the late 50s. And we, at the time I was growing up, were literally one of only two black families living on the street in South London, where I grew up. And it was a tough time. What I learned, I think, as a child and later on as a teenager, is that racism and prejudice is extremely complex. And it's inspired and motivated by many, many different things.
Amma hopes the film will raise awareness of the prejudices and racism that still exists today. Gugu's father is South African, and as such, she's had her own experiences of racism. But she feels those negative encounters helped her create something positive in her role as Belle.
The issue of identity, which we deal with in the film, is something that, you know, I deal with in my daily life and through my work. And it was really wonderful to have a role that explores that duality of being of mixed heritage, you know, not having to pick a side or feel like you're being labelled one or the other, but to kind of celebrate both cultures.
The film hasn't yet been screened in any African countries, but Amma says there's already a lot of interest.
Lots of people tweeting me from Africa, telling me how much they're looking forward to the movie. And of course, knowing that two African women are involved with the movie, you know, they have a greater focus on the movie because of that. So for me, I'm excited to see how they will respond and react to the movie when they do finally see it.
With its International Day of Remembrance and the screening of this film, the United Nations is honouring those who suffered and died during one of the darkest chapters in human history. Later this year, it will unveil a statue outside its New York headquarters as a permanent memorial to slavery and its long-lasting effects. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact the show via email reports@featurestory.com and look us up on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, the Israeli entrepreneurs trying to close the gender gap in Silicon Valley. That's Friday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.